90.7 FM KPFK. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Restless Soul, where tonight my guest on the telephone, live and direct from New York City, is DJ Donna Edwards. In my opinion, someone that the LA audience and the world should definitely know way more about. She is one of the most underexposed DJ, male, female, hands down, anywhere in the world, and I thought it was high time that the LA audience got a chance to get to know Donna, hear her mixes, find out what inspires her, and just begin to start spreading the gospel that is Donna Edwards. So Donna, thank you very much for taking the time out of your schedule to, you know, talk to me.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start from the beginning. Where were you when you fell in love with house music?
With house music, I would say my first real exposure was at Empire Skate Rink in Brooklyn. A veteran DJ, T. Scott, been there and at various other clubs around the city, but it had to be the skate rink because I spent most of my young days skating.
So tell us, for those who've never been to Empire Skating Rink, set it up for us. What's it like? What was the music that T was dropping? Why was it such a pivotal moment for you?
Oh, man. I mean, the space is huge. It was so large that you had two separate rinks. We had a rink for, we would say, the professionals, where everyone is just skating, beating around, dancing on skates. And you had the smaller rink where, you know, the younger people and the people that couldn't really skate well would learn. And the sound system was awesome. An original Richard Long sound system.
Ooh.
The same guy that put the system in at the Paradise Garage in New York. I mean, it was incredible. Just the place alone, between that, the sound, and the type of DJ T. Scott was, he was awesome. I mean, he played everything, R&B, rock, house, you know, the emerging, then we didn't even consider it house. It was just music, underground, whatever it was. He just played it. If it was good, he played it.
What time period are we talking about?
What time period?
What was it, 75
early,
or?
Early 80s, around 82, 81. You had T. Scott, a guy named Horace, Big Bob. Those were the resident DJs at Empire during that time.
I take it you were in the big professional rink.
Oh, definitely. I had to be. I mean, I've been skating since I was 6 years old, and I never stopped. It's like, I guess, going to class to take dance lessons. If you've been doing it for those many years, you got to learn something.
Right.
I just loved it.
Can I ask, at the time, how old were you then?
I'm 82.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a sense of...
Give up my age.
I'm just trying to get a sense of where...
I was 17 at the time.
You were 17. Okay. This was not, or was it, your first exposure to DJing?
No, it wasn't my first exposure. I mean, as far as live and being out, dancing on skates and hanging out, really getting into the groove of music, that was my first real raw experience. But I can remember days of going out in the 70s, the mid-70s, to block parties where you had people like Grandmaster Flash coming to Brooklyn to play in the parks and at the block parties, Grandmaster Flowers, so many great DJs back then.
What was it about house as opposed to the hip-hop, since the hip-hop was kind of more in your neighborhood, literally on the streets?
Yeah, exactly. The sound was different. What they played was different on the streets. You would hear things like Super Sperm by Captain Sky, Rock the Bell, mostly the hip-hop-oriented type songs. They played a few disco tunes, but not like they would do in the skate rink. So in that respect, I knew what I really loved and would gravitate towards. That's why I spent most of my time skating or trying to get to any party that I could sneak in at that age.
And the house music, it was what? The vocals, the beat?
Everything, the vocals, the rhythm. It was different. Just listening to the drum machines, the 808 drum machines, it was just raw, a different sound being introduced along with the disco.
And at that time, did you already have equipment on your own?
No, I got my first set when I was 17. My brother actually bought it for my birthday because I was like really excited and kind of begged him for it. I was like, I can play, I can do this, man. So he was like, you know, he knew I loved music because I was always out, or if I had to go somewhere where I couldn't get in, he would actually be the one to take me because he's 4 years older than me. And he knew, he believed in me. He loved music also, so he couldn't deny me that, I guess.
And what was it about DJing that you thought instinctively, yeah, I can do that?
It just, I mean, it was natural for me.
Had you ever been somewhere else, like another friend or someone who could, who had turntables that you could practice on, or?
Actually, no, I never had the chance to really practice. My cousin had a setup, my cousin Roger. I played once or twice on his setup, but I used to just basically watch the DJs and what they were doing, and I mean, I had a sense of rhythm already because I was always dancing on skates, and that's, like, to me, phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
To keep the beat and to be able to twirl and jump and come back down on beat.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, if I could do that, and plus I played the trumpet, it was like, if I could do those things, I could do anything.
So music was definitely a part of your background.
Yeah.
Whether it was going to be DJing or somehow it seems like you would have always had your hand in something musical.
Yeah.
So your older brother hooked you up with your first system. Is it just you and your brother? You come from a big family?
No, I would say it's medium. It's four of us. Three girls, one boy. I'm the youngest.
While music was obviously a part of your household, are you someone who, out of all the siblings, are you the one who decided to make a conscious effort to have a career in it in some way?
Definitely. At one point, I thought my brother would because he can sing. He's a musician also, but he didn't want to pursue it. I mean, he's very talented, but just didn't want to pursue it. I couldn't see myself letting it go totally. Rather, it was the DJing. The trumpet thing is like, I loved it. I couldn't see myself touring and playing a trumpet. Like, oh no.
Not that. I'd rather lug crates of records around.
Yeah, it was like, I couldn't see it. But I could see myself playing records and dancing the rest of my life until I'm 80. I could see myself skating until I'm 80.
Right.
You know, because that's something healthy, and it won't take much out of me.
And in New York, you could always go to Washington Square Park and do it. And, you know, you could do it wherever, but
right.
Certainly there were big communities.
You still have the indoor rinks in New York. New York is a very versatile place. Even with the traveling, with the music, I like just going and playing.
And so going back to Empire, truly, I mean, the Empire is definitely the main place that you can hear music because you can't get into the clubs. So in terms of the real clubs where dancing was done, where were you sneaking into?
Places like Better Days, T. Scott played there also. Oh, it was so many. The Nickel Bar. Steps up. I mean, it was so many different clubs. Buttermilk Bottom.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of places. So many. Some of them I can't even remember names, but I remember where they are. Rax is in New York too. That was a Tuesday night party.
Okay.
I would leave skating and go there. It's weird. I don't know. Everywhere. The Roxy on Monday night, but that was a skate night. I was all over the place.
Other than skating, you can do in the rink and dancing. I mean, was there anything else different that you noticed about how people were sort of reacting to the music from the rink to the clubs?
Oh, definitely. At the skate rink, T played a lot of funky type groups. He would play faster paced songs, but not as much like on the house tip, most of the Chicago stuff. He played it here and there, but not as much as if you went to the club, because it's some of the songs, I don't care how much you pitched it down, it just didn't feel right. So just to learn the difference in that was important.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a great lesson to learn and just to see it, the difference, and to experience the difference.
Tell us about your experiences then starting to play out. You know, how long after you got your first set of turntables did you begin to sort of venture out and do, I guess, your own little block parties, or did you do school dances? You do the regular kind of beginning stuff, or did you somehow manage to go straight to the clubs?
No, I didn't go straight to the clubs, but I was still pretty picky. I refused to do block parties for some reason. I think because of actually being in the block parties, it was beautiful, but sometimes it could get kind of rowdy.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to get caught up in, I guess, the ugly side of it.
Mm-hmm.
If anything happened, because I would have to be the one to be running with my equipment or have somebody running with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nah, I don't think that's an option. I mostly went with wedding receptions, birthday functions, private family functions to start off. That's where I really got my start at. And my first gig in a bar lounge was actually for one of my older cousins. That was my first and only 12-hour gig. I played for 12 hours. I was like exhausted. I was like, you people got to go home because I can't do this.
For 12 hours?
12 hours. The first and only time I've ever done it. And I vowed to never do it again.
And what do you remember about that 12-hour time here besides being exhausted? How was it for you to try and bring what you had learned or experienced at the rink to a bar at that point, or a party?
I kind of experimented on them to see what they would like from records that we would play in the street or in the skate ring or in the club. Whichever ones they kind of responded to the most, I stuck with that. Just went from there.
And what were the records that you found that they responded to? Because essentially, this is the beginning of the quote-unquote Donna Edwards sound, right? This is, I mean, you already know what you like to listen to, but now that you're able to perform for other people and make them dance and rock their parties, seeing what people respond to, I would imagine that would begin to influence your ear even more.
Yeah, I think it did. From looking back, mostly the classics like My Love Is Free, Love Is the Message, and some of the house tunes at that time, the Chicago-based stuff, they really loved it. They wasn't too crazy about the rap-influenced stuff at that time.
Oh, really?
The party, no. They rather listen to songs that had fluid instrumentation and vocals, positive lyrics, but it worked out pretty good. That was my first lesson in really learning for myself, performing and seeing what I should do and not do as a DJ.
And what did you see that you shouldn't do as a DJ?
Don't foresee what they don't want. Some DJs are ego tripping and play whatever they like for an hour or 2 hours. Sometimes I've seen people do it and it's like no response on the dance floor. You can't do that. It's not good business and it doesn't look good for you either as a DJ.
What were you at this point trying to force feed people that you felt that they weren't responding to?
The pop rap, at that time, it was kind of fading out, the Sugar Hill Gang type stuff. And like I said, the Captain Sky rap tunes, things like that. So I said, oh, I guess I have to play the older stuff, like the disco era, and try some of the newer stuff because they weren't real club people or skaters like I was. Kind of introducing them to the underground house scene at the time, and it worked because they liked the difference. To me, it was a form of disco, but just take it to a higher level in a quicker pace.
Before your first residency, how long did it take before you could get one? How many years were you kind of just doing parties here and there?
Wow, a long time.
Like 5 years, 6 years?
My first residency was in 1991, so it was a pretty long time, probably like 7-8 years, because it was hard to actually land residency in major clubs back then because you had the cream of the crop still playing, still living. Guys like Larry Levan, T. Scott, may they rest in peace. These guys were still around and they ruled the major club here in New York.
So where was your first residency? How did that come about?
My first residency was for a promoter named Trey. It was for Trey's production. It was an all-female party they did on the west side in the West Village on James Street, mm-hmm. 1991. At that time, she had another DJ, a guy named Jason Lode, working for her, but she decided that she had knew me for previous years, and we just kind of got in contact with each other again, and she decided she wanted to have a female DJ because it was a female party. So she asked me if I would come in and be her resident DJ for the party, so it started there. We'll be right back.
What was the name of that party?
The name of the party was actually the Dean Street Cafe Party.
So was this your first women's party that you'd ever played?
Yes.
So what was that like? Because there's got to be a difference. I mean, I personally think there's a difference. I don't know if I'm biased, but my experience is women, they like their pop music, I'll say, and they're not as open to newer sounds and different sounds. Like, they like Madonna or whoever that is, and that's what they want to hear.
Right, you're absolutely right. You hit it right on the head.
Okay.
They're totally just shut off to new. I mean, you have to pretty much force feed them. If you want to have them listen to a new tune and learn it, you have to play it for months. And it's like, okay, can we get past this? You know? So I had to be patient, learn to be patient in that aspect, and learn how to actually do it to get them to like songs or to have something different. Also, I couldn't just play house. I had to play everything, R&B, hip-hop, reggae.
But in terms of those records that were less underground, let's say, were those records already a part of your collection, or did you really have to go out and do some new kind of shopping for this party?
No, already a part of my collection. I always collected everything. I was always into everything. You know, I love house, I love classics, but I collect everything, rock, vintage reggae, jazz. I don't know, I still do actually, but I haven't played a hip-hop party in probably the last four or five years.
Back to the women's party thing for a second. Why do you think that is, that it's so hard when you're doing a traditionally lesbian party, I'll say? Because obviously you have the women at a mixed house night. They're, you know, they're just like the guys. They're there for the DJ. They're there for the music. They will go on the journey. You know what I mean? They don't have to hear the same top 10 radio hits. What do you think it is about kind of the collective group of women at a lesbian party?
I try to figure it out. I don't think I have ever figured it out. I don't know. I can't figure it out after all these years. I don't want to make a biased statement. Maybe it's because of them only going to their own type of function. Most of them, I would say, go to only lesbian functions. Mm-hmm. So they don't venture outside of that. So they're kind of stuck in a rut. Most of the other DJs also don't try to educate them musically. They just give them the top 10 of this, the top 10 of that, and don't try anything else, and that's not good. So it could be that also, a combination of both, I think.
And so how long did you maintain this residency at Jane's Cafe?
I think we were there for a year, actually maybe 2 years we were there, and then she partnered up with a lady at the Silver Shadow. She went there, Caroline, for the Hershey Bar party. She did a couple of parties there, and then she left there and went to the Warehouse with Charles Jackson and Mike Stone gave their party. But Charles and Mike's party was on Saturdays, and she did her party on Friday. So I went from club to club.
With her?
With her for the residencies. And her last stint in a major venue was at the Brooklyn Cafe. And that's the last residency I had with her. Now she's not doing any functions at the moment. But that was the longest I've ever been with one promoter.
Okay.
And Charles Jackson. I still work for him occasionally, time to time, for special parties at the Roxy.
And so after your run with her ended, where did you go?
Back to work with Charles Jackson.
So then you basically went from there to the Warehouse.
Yeah, we went to the Warehouse, then the Brooklyn Cafe, and I went back to the Warehouse to work with Charles Jackson again.
And tell us about the Warehouse. Where is it located? What kind of spot is it?
The Warehouse is in the Bronx on East 140th Street.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty huge space. Nice sound system. I was comfortable there. The staff is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And the patrons are pretty decent. Not too, how could I put it?
So they're not really heads.
Right.
It could be a lounge. They don't care. They just want a place to really socialize.
Right. But it just happens to be a bigger space where you had two levels where you could have the hip hop in one room and the house and classics in another. That was my job. I did the main floor, the house and classics for the girl parties and the boy parties.
Okay, two separate parties. They're not mixed yet. Compared to Jane Street, were the rooms the same? The large floor at the Warehouse hold the same amount of people?
Jane Street was smaller than the Warehouse.
So you moved straight to the big room, which I guess today is a big deal. But back then, it was just, you know, no big thing, right?
No, to me, I didn't even look at it like that. I was like, I got to go. I'm doing what I love to do, you know, no matter what size room it is. It just so happened that my first residencies happened to be in all large rooms.
Okay.
So I was lucky to even have something like that. A place like the Silver Shadow, that's a legendary club.
Yeah.
It's huge. You know, to be a resident there, it's like, okay, I love it. To play at the Roxy is another, you know, it's a blessing.
What were the numbers? How many people could it hold? The warehouse?
The warehouse, 1,000+. That's the numbers we had. Minimum 800 people each function. And that's for Trey's party.
Okay.
Charles Jackson's got even more numbers. He got close to 1,500 to 1,700 every weekend.
And part of this is because people don't have to travel. I'm imagining a lot of these are Bronx residents, or these people from all five boroughs?
People came from all over.
Okay.
All five boroughs, out of state. It's like people like Tracy and Charles and Mike, they've been giving parties for a long time, ever since all of this pretty much started with Al Gates Group. I would say, like, I'm almost 40.
Okay.
And they're a couple of years older than me. They're like right in the middle of where everything started. They've been doing it and never stopped. So they got a huge following.
And also, I guess as well, because they were throwing gay parties. They were catering.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And that's pretty much, I guess, mostly where the scene really started.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what I saw, my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've seen as a patron, going from a patron to a DJ, I knew the places that I had to go to hear the music that really moved me. It was mostly the gay parties, you know. No question about it. They played more of the underground, or I wouldn't even call it underground, more unreleased tunes that the radio station wouldn't even get for months. They got their hands on it.
Okay.
First. So you had to go. You want to go hear the Peach Boys' Don't Make Me Wait.
Mm-hmm.
Larry LeVan first one to have that. That's his record. The radio station didn't have it, you know. Certain things T produced. T Scott had it, so you had to go where he was to hear it. It wasn't going to be on the radio for months. Maybe not at all. That's how I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it came across to me, because that's how it was. I mean, pretty much all the straight parties that I did attend, I could pretty much tell you it was going to be all the top radio tunes from KTU to ELF. And it depends on which party you went to and what borough it was in.
Mm-hmm.
If it would be more rap influenced or more R&B influenced. Like, if I went to parties in Brooklyn, most likely I heard more R&B influenced songs. Disco. If I went uptown or the Bronx at that time, the party, they played a lot of rap stuff, and I was never really into it.
So how do you rock a party for 1,000 people?
Wait. You pray first, and then you put the first record on and see where it goes. I mean, for me, I don't have no set formula. I just look at the crowd. I try to determine the age group, and whichever age group rules, that's where I start my music. You know what I mean?
So if you're looking out at the crowd at the warehouse at the time, and it's people in your age group, which is what?
At that time, it would be the early 30s,
okay.
late 20s.
So what record do you start your night with for that age group?
Definitely classic. Any down-tempo classic. I don't like to start off with this real high energy, because where do you go from here? You know, it's like you're running out the box before you even walk in. So I kind of start at a down-tempo pace with classics.
So give me a record. Your age group, you're starting a party, a down-tempo record, it is who?
What You Gonna Do With My Lovin'?
Stephanie Mills?
No, the remix by Frankie Knuckles.
Okay.
Yeah, see, and that's the house version of it instead of the R&B version. Things like that I would start off with. And if they were younger, 5 to 7 or 8 years younger, than what I am, I would probably do a remix house version of an R&B artist that they're age. You know what I mean?
Okay, so if we're looking at it today, let's say same scenario, but for the younger crowd, let's say you would put on what, a Jill Scott remix?
Yeah,
okay.
Jill Scott or Floor Tree, someone they know and that they're grooving to now to get them interested. Once you catch them, just go from there.
You keep building on that artist bracket until the pace of the floor just starts to pick up.
Right. When it gets to the point where I feel I could do anything with them, then that's where I'm gone. That's when I just go to wherever I want to go. Or I would experiment and play something that they've never heard to try to get them to see, oh, this is a new groove and it's cool.
And how do you know, looking out at the crowd? I'm assuming any good DJ is keeping their eye on the crowd, right? Because you want to see, you know, when the energy's off or what you're doing isn't working. But when you're starting off and you're getting the night going, you start off, you know, you're on a roller coaster. It's a journey. So like you said, you kind of walk in and then you may be skipping and trotting before you get a full out dash. But when do you know? What is your clue when you're communicating with the audience that, okay, yeah, it's time, I can step it up? What are you looking for on the dance floor?
I guess mainly the people that come on the floor to dance and some of the people that stand around the perimeter. They may be a little shy of dancing, but they'll stand there. They won't go back to the bar and just bob their head, you know, kind of sing along with whatever song is playing. Play a lot of vocals in the beginning. Once you get them singing pretty much and they're dancing and standing there, in there on the dance floor and they don't want to leave, you take them to the next level, you peek out, then you bring it back down and bring it back up. It's like an interval. I mean, sometimes I know, especially with the women, you got to let them breathe. But they do have to go to the bathroom, get drinks, because they are going to drink.
Fix their makeup.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. They got to always be cute.
Right.
That's one thing you can't take away from the women when they're dancing. You have a few sisters that really get down because they're professional dancers.
Right.
And they love to dance. But for the most part, the majority of them, they definitely oppose it.
Right.
But they will dance, but they're not going to sweat. Coolest dancers on the earth.
Love my sisters.
Yeah, they'll give you the two-step all night, and I appreciate it. All night long. They won't even sit down. They run to the bathroom, get that drink, and they come back, and they two-step the whole night. But at least they give you the effort and
right.
the energy, and they stay there.
Absolutely.
But they like anthem-type songs, too.
Mm-hmm.
The women, the female party.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big difference.
And the guys will just go for anything.
Anything under the sun. You could play a big mambo record for them. They don't care. They'll dance to it.
They just want to be worked out.
Right. Those are the real dancers. The gay guys, oh my God. Energy upon energy.
The warehouse party, you continued a residency there for how long?
I stayed until the year of 2000. I was there from 96 to, 96 to 2000. Then I went to the Brooklyn Cafe. I stayed there a year. Then I went back for 1 year with Charles Jackson.
To the warehouse?
Yeah. I was there from 96 to 2000 with Trey's production on a Friday night. And during that time, I would do some Saturdays playing with Andre Collins' party. But once Tracy left the warehouse and she went to the Brooklyn Cafe, we did our stint there. I went back because Charles took over the girl party for the Friday. And I just stayed there for a year. And then I left and started doing other things that I wanted to pursue in Brooklyn and traveling more.
Can I ask what the other things were? Were they other parties you wanted to try? Or?
Yeah, mainly other parties. You know, working with other DJs that I didn't have the opportunity to work with. Like, for instance, all those years, the only downside about having a residency, other promoters and other DJs would invite me to play at other venues, and I couldn't do it even if I wanted to.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was already locked into my own night gig, so I couldn't leave there and go play someone else.
Right.
Somewhere else, unless it was an out-of-state or out-of-town gig.
Even if it was an off night? If someone was throwing a Monday night party or something?
If it was an off night, yes, but most of the time it was during the same night that I had my residency.
Sure.
So it's like, I missed a lot of opportunities to just be in different places, different environments, and playing with other talented people.
And so you got to play out more, and you got to experience then, once you left the warehouse, some of these other parties.
Yeah, some of the other parties, the patrons.
Who were these other parties? What were they?
Some of the other parties, like, for instance, I had the opportunity to play with a guy named, he's a DJ, Oscar Fuller. He was doing a couple of different functions on Fridays at different locations, and I just love playing with this guy. He's got incredible energy, and that's where, at the time, I think it was a place in Brooklyn, it'll come to me, but it was a place where I met the current DJs that I play with, Little Ray. I mean, this guy, his energy is out of control. I love the way he plays, and I can feed off of him as a DJ. It's just, I mean, it's different when you're playing by yourself all night, when you have to work with people that actually can enhance what you do. It feels great.
In case you're just tuning in, this is Restless Soul on 90.7 FM, KPFK. We're talking with DJ Donna Edwards, who's coming to us from New York City. We're talking about energy and feeding off other people. Now we're in a time where it's very rare to go to a club and have one DJ all night. Now you have two, three, four, five DJs on the bill. Is that the norm for you now, having another DJ play, or do you,
no,
I mean?
No, I still very much enjoy playing by myself. I'll never get rid of that feeling and what it is to actually do it alone. But it's nice to have had the opportunity to play with other people and to feel their energy. I wouldn't make it a permanent part of my career,
mm-hmm.
because I'd still do solo gigs or guest spots where I'm doing 4 and 5 hours by myself. Or for instance, like when Ray and I played at the Shelter, I did the first 8 hours, he did, you know, the last part of the party, but I played the first 8 hours by myself, and then he came. No, I don't want people to think that, oh, she can't do the 8 hours by herself. I definitely can.
Sure, you could rock it by yourself, Donna.
Oh, I love it.
No question. You met Little Ray at another party. He inspired you. People loved it. That is great when you have another DJ alongside you that just helps elevate your game. You all have since paired up, right, for a
yes,
new party that you're doing?
Yes, we were doing, we were playing together, him, myself, and Tyrone France. We were playing every Wednesday at the BKNY party at 667 Lounge. We were there, I think, 3 years, and it worked out really well, the combination of DJs and the energy, and we just decided to stay together doing that particular party until we had to switch locations because of cabaret license problems, things like that. But now we're starting a Friday event, the three of us. You know, we just want to have one night of the week
mm-hmm.
where we all are together and we're doing our thing as far as that energy level.
And so how does the night get broken up? Does Tyrone play one type of music and Lil Ray one and you another? Are you all playing the same thing? How does that work in terms of consistency of sound or what all the three DJs bring to a party?
I think the consistency is at any given time we can play the same thing. If it's called for, like if it's a record that's just hot and it's blazing and it needs to be broken, all three of us will play it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To give that artist and that record the proper props that it deserves and to let the crowd hear it because it deserves to be played more than once. And in that case, yes. But other than that, we pretty much play our own individual styles.
And what is your style, Donna?
It's hard. I don't think I have a style. Like I said, it depends. I don't have a style until the actual night comes when I see the people that come in to the party. That's when my style comes into place. I can't say that, okay, tonight I'm gonna play all new stuff or just classics. I'll never know.
Do you have a sense of what people think your style is? Like, what would someone else say your style is?
Well, most people label me as the classic DJ because I guess, I don't know why, because I'm always playing classics. For instance, for the women party.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Donna's the one, she throws down the classics compared to the other DJs that play for their parties and their functions. If you go to the male crowd or male crowd, they'll say Donna's the one, she just rips the house. And the real old school down-tempo R&B classics, that's what they feel my style is.
Classic being the word
right.
that has linked you. But that's not obviously all you give them.
No, I mean, I play a wide variety of things. I play a lot of the new material that's out now, the new sound that has more of the Afro-Cuban type beat. Most of the percussion that sounds, not Afro-Cuban, but mostly, how would I...
Just heavy percussive stuff.
Brazilian type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I play a lot of things on that level, but I still stick close to the R&B bass house because it works. It's hard. There's very few good vocals, so you have to go with what you have to.
I want to jump back in time for a bit. I mean, obviously you're influenced by your environment and what you grew up listening to, but one person who you seem to really gravitate towards was T. Scott. So I wanted you to talk about him for a bit. because again, there were a lot of the legends going on at the time, right? Larry was playing and David Mancuso, and a lot of people, when they talk about DJs and who influenced them, you know, those names, Larry is always right there on people's tongue. And you are mentioning T, which is cool because people need to remember there were tons of DJs doing work in this movement, you know, at the time. So talk to us a little about T. Scott, because I don't think many people really know about him.
I think I really chose T. Scott over the rest of the DJs because he actually took the time to come play outside of the clubs and to come into the skating rink, you know, and play for the younger people as well as people that was there that was his age that was still skating at the time. He gave us a chance, in other words, to give us a piece of him, what he knew, and it was the blessing. I mean, I've never heard of Larry or any of the other top DJs at the time, David Mancuso, playing and functioning in an environment such as a skate ring where you have younger people just getting down. He gave back to the community in a sense by doing that, other than the talent that he had. I mean, this guy, he would play and mix in the break, not scratching, but mixing in the break with live instruments, things like that. That's a hard thing to do. It's not easy.
So when you're saying he played at a place like the skating rink, was he doing Better Days at the same time?
Yes, he was doing it at the same time.
Okay.
That's what I mean. He took time. I mean, I'm sure he was doing Zanzibar, doing one time too over in Jersey. And I'm sure he probably had offers to do other mega clubs, but he wanted to play and he came and played at Empire Skating Rink.
I'm assuming you got a chance to go up to him and talk to him, tell him about your love for the DJing, and what did he show you some things and, you know, give you some tricks and like mentor you in that way?
I wouldn't say he showed me anything, but he would always speak, and if I had any questions, he would answer or ask them the name of a record and what label it was on.
Mm-hmm.
He would tell me, and I can remember my first time ever speaking face-to-face, and I told him how much I loved what he did and that I wanted to DJ. He told me, just start doing it. You know, you can do it. Whatever you want to do, don't let nobody tell you you can't do it. That was his exact words and advice to me.
Mm.
And I was like, coming from him, then I, you know, I definitely can do this too, you know, because it was kind of odd back then. Most people was like, women don't DJ. Like, we can dance, we can DJ. So what's the difference? But he was very positive in that aspect of it. He wasn't snobbish, turning up his nose, though a woman DJ, or just, you know, having that kind of ego trip type thing about him.
Mm-hmm.
Really nice. A nice guy and sincere. If he felt for any reason that I couldn't do it, I'm sure he would have said it because he was an honest type guy. But he didn't. You know, he watched me grow up pretty much skating on that dance floor. Saw my rhythms and what I had in me. So, of course, if anyone could see it, he should see it. That's the way I felt. Sometimes he'd make his own edits of certain songs, like Love is the Message and My Love is Free and The Tramp, The Night the Lights Went Out. And I've never in my life heard songs the way he put them together. It's like, oh, God, he's going to kill us.
And how did he put it together?
Rearranged the entire track itself, or he would just do it where he had the hottest parts of the songs and put the edit together on the reel and play it. And for a skater, that's like the most phenomenal thing because you live to skate on the break.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Especially if you're the type of skater where you're competing and you're doing shows. Everything is in the moves on. It's like impact point. And T. Scott, I think he was one of the first ones to figure that out as far as even the skaters. And it just made it that more exciting, too.
Skating is a different rhythm and it's a whole different activity than dancing. So you as someone in terms of your DJing that uses a lot of double records?
A lot of double records. Sometimes I'll play three at once. It depends on how I'm feeling.
So you get that groove going forever.
I try.
Before you drop the vocal again.
I try.
Wow. And then someone else that you mentioned was Andre Collins.
Oh, Andre was another one of those guys I met back then during the Better Days days. He had played a few times over there at Better Days for T. Scott sometimes and with bars. And his energy, too, was very unique. And his style and his awareness of the floor and just programming, putting the right music together. together and playing the right songs at the right time to have an effect on the crowd. Some days he would have you screaming or you wanting to cry, you just want to stomp the floor. Just, I mean, I think back about him playing, and he just touched me from day one. It's weird because we developed a friendship since those days. We're still in each other's lives to this day now.
Really? Well, that's the beauty about this music and this culture is that it creates family. The ability for a DJ to make 1,000 people week after week come together and feel close and, you know, get to know each other's name and commune in this haven of music, that's really something special.
That's true. It's very true. It's one of those amazing gifts that, you know, you can develop if you have the talent and if you keep your dreams and you pursue and live out your dreams of what you do. Other than the God-given talent that was given to you, everybody don't have it.
Right.
That's for sure.
Right.
And the few that do have it, I say God bless them.
Also, just want to remind people, this is 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles. We're also heard at 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara County and on the web at www.kpfk.org. My name is Christy Lomax. I'm your host and DJ for this program, Restless Soul, which airs every Monday night from 10:30 p.m. until midnight. We're talking to DJ Donna Edwards from New York City. Definitely somebody I've wanted to get in touch with and talk to for a long time. You've been somebody that, for myself as a black woman and a DJ, in terms of me looking for other people doing what I do, you've just been the person whose name and then mixes just keep coming up. You know, every time I feel like I'm out there trying to find other sisters that are doing what I'm doing, and not, you know, DJing for sure, but certainly playing the music that we're playing. You know, you go and you listen to mixes, and it turns out that it's a little bit trancey, or it's a lot of drum and bassy, but it's not quite what I was looking for. So for me, this is a treat and an honor to actually talk to you, because you've just been an inspiration for the length of time you've been in the business doing it, for the quality of the music that you provide, the skills you have. It's a real pleasure for me to actually talk to you. So thanks.
No, thank you.
I appreciate it.
The pleasure is all mine.
But the thing that I wanted to touch on, there were two things that you mentioned while we were talking, is that you said that you had the opportunity to play The Shelter. And you, even though you played it with Little Ray, The Shelter's been going on for 13 years, right? And correct me if I'm wrong, but you were the first woman to ever play The Shelter's big room?
The first woman, yes. The first woman, DJ.
Didn't Jeannie Hopper play there, like, once she opened? I wasn't sure if that was before you or after you.
That was after.
So I wanted to talk to you about this idea of, you know, women DJs, and especially, you know, for what we're doing. The scene, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but from where I stand, it would appear... Okay, let me see. I don't even know where to go there. Do you find in your travels that there are as many women DJs throwing the music down the way you're doing, you know, your brand of house music? Are there a lot? Are you seeing that in your travels?
Not at all.
Okay.
I want to see just one. Actually, I mean, it's... You would think that it would make me be disheartened about it, but it just makes me want to do it even more and even longer, because I haven't seen it or experienced it to that level, to what I'm doing right now. If I run into other female DJs, it's like you said, they're playing that other side of the music, the drum and bass or the trance or hip-hop and reggae. I mean, and they're at the top of their game at what they do. They don't play what I play. And it's kind of like, oh, I'm the only one. You know, sometimes it gets lonely. But somebody has to do it. I would rather be equal to how many males that are into it doing what we do. But it's hard. I don't know. A lot of them also, they just going for the quick money, and you get more gigs with the hip-hop party. There's very few underground parties to go around where there's a spare slot open.
It wasn't strange for you then to realize that you are the first woman to ever play The Shelter in its 13-year history?
No, I didn't think I would be, though, because you had other female DJs like DJ Cosmo that used to live here in New York, but she's living in Europe now.
Mm-hmm.
She's a phenomenal DJ. She's great. I don't know if she was ever offered the opportunity to play at places like The Shelter or Body and Soul on Sundays in New York, But I thought she would have been the first one to be asked to play because she had done some production, different records with different artists. They pretty much base a lot of bookings on that too nowadays.
Right.
But they never gave her the opportunity to do Shelter. So I was kind of surprised at that.
Did you get a chance to meet her? So you do know one other person.
Yes, I know Cosmo.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as being here and in New York and still doing, even Cosmo, she's not really playing so much on the soulful side of it now. She's playing different types of things.
So what was that like to go and rock the Shelter? Because from what I understand, you rocked it. You know, you brought it.
I mean, it felt like it should feel. It was at first very surprising. Oh, you can't believe it, but it is happening. So you got to do your best. You better do your best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you are the first and the only woman
mm-hmm.
at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't let yourself down. You can't let the people down that have been supporting you all those years, your family, your friends.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and most important, the patrons, the dancers, the real people that count. You can't let them down. So you got to do your job. You got to do it no matter what.
And what makes that Shelter crowd so special? You know, what makes them like one of the hardest crowds in the world to please?
They've been given the best music for 13 years by the maestro himself. That's a hard thing to live up to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you step on the floor and when you go in the booth to play, you better be ready. They will let you know. They will let you know.
Many of feelings have gotten hurt, huh?
Oh, yeah. They don't care about feelings. It's like it's time to get down. It's like a release. It's like a sanctuary. It's like having your own private spiritualness within the music and on the dance floor at the same time. If anything is broken where it's not feeling good, they'll let you know. Even if it's technical problems with the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
It happens too many times. Oh, they're going to let you have it.
Because
they feel, oh, you're in the best club. You got the best sound system. Shouldn't be problems.
Right, right.
And if you're asked to play, you should be able to bring it the same as Timmy would, which is true, you know?
Some big shoes to fill, Mr. Regisford.
Yeah.
It was you and Little Ray. So did you have time by yourself and then you all shared it?
Just me and Little Ray. Timmy was actually touring in Japan at that time, so he asked Ray and myself to cover the night for him. And I decided that I wanted to open and Ray closed.
Really?
Yeah.
Why was that?
Because the energy level at that time in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, I didn't feel like I'm used to starting my clock. But, you know, I start at 10, 11 o'clock. To actually come in and start a party at 7, 8 in the morning, I don't think my body or my brain would even tell me to do it. So I was like, I didn't want to, you know, chance that and not have the correct energy I would need, you know, because I've never done that. So I wanted to do what I normally do, which is play an 6 to 8 hour set
mm-hmm.
straight and just have the energy level up
mm-hmm.
all night long and never let them breathe. That night, I planned to not let them breathe.
Did you tape that night, Donna?
Actually, no. We didn't record.
Oh, man.
At all. Kind of, we were rushing out and left all the DAT tapes at home.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
I was a part of the nervousness of
mm-hmm.
it all.
So you just refused to take them on your normal journey of peaks and valleys. You just kind of like, boom. They walked in the door. The minute they hit the floor, they were gone.
Yeah, I did a few peaks and valleys, but not as much as I normally would do. Because there, the way the Shelter crowd is and the way the dancers are, the people are really professional, mostly professional dancers or dancers that just dance for hours and hours, you know, without
mm-hmm.
taking breaks. And the energy has to be at a certain level anyway. You can't go up and down too much because that would exhaust them more as a dancer.
One of the other things you mentioned was the fact that I guess you're feeling that vocal records aren't as strong as they used to be.
Right.
Are you feeling like it's just the vocal records that are suffering, or do you feel like the house music overall lately, I guess within the last 5 years, 10 years or so, isn't as good as it used to be?
Well, I would say overall house itself, the music has been suffering, and I think for several reasons, because you have everybody and their mother and brother producing records now, because you could do them basically off your computer in your own home, and they have no type of musical training. And the most of it's garbage. Before years, like let's say 10 years ago, you can go in the store and get 30 records and not have to listen to them. Just go and pay for it and walk out.
Mm-hmm.
Now you got to listen to 60 records, take 3 hours, and walk out with 3 records. That's not good, you know?
And do you feel that's back 10 years ago when you were doing that? Are those were labels that you knew and could trust that have now folded, or artists that were making music that are no longer producing?
Right. You have artists that were in the game then that are no longer doing it now. Some of the labels are gone, like Strictly Rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they put out a lot of hits.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of hits.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't dare question most of the time, especially the early days, what would be a good song or not. You know, you have some of the newer labels. Like, it's hard. You have to really be choosy, take time to sift through the music and pick the right for your crowd and introduce them to some of the newer music or the newer sounds that could take it to the next level. But believe it and keep playing it. Some people will buy it, play it once and never play it again. That doesn't help the scene or the artist. Know, or they'll play a record and say, oh, it's old. A record is never old. You know, I hate when they...
I know. Where do you think that mentality came from? I mean, we're... Granted, because of the way record sales and things are now, folks can't afford to press up a lot of records, or, you know, as many as they used to, and shelf life in terms of buying the record is a lot shorter. You know, sometimes what you have in the store on their new record day, you know, when it's gone, it's gone. That you may never get any more in because the labels, these are all independent small labels run, you know, out of people's kitchens. Is, you know what I mean? It's small
right.
operations. But it seems like the mentality of DJs as well is like they'll play the record for days, those first 2 weeks. But, you know, for the next week or so when the new records are out, that's it. The record they just bought last week is gone.
Right. I think most of the people, most of the DJs that are doing it don't have much club experience or any kind of experience playing out. So they don't even know where to base or judge a record, how long it should be played or if it should be shelved. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They say they're looking to actually try and get this gig. And they want to play the newest of the new,
mm-hmm.
or the unreleased,
mm-hmm.
if no one else has it. And it's really not about that. It's about the people, and most of the time, the people want to hear something that's old, that they know, that
mm-hmm.
they can sing,
mm-hmm.
or a rhythm that made them fall in love with a certain person or whatever. Whatever it may be to help them identify with something that makes them feel good when they're on that dance floor. And it's 9 times out of 10, it's going to be something old, not something new, or you decided you shouldn't play it because you've played it for 2 weeks. You know what I mean? The concept of that drives me crazy. I can't see it.
And you think that's lack of club experience, or is it
Definitely
just to keep
lack.
Up with the Joneses?
No, it's no... In this business, to me, there's no such thing as Joneses. It's all about the promoter, the club owner, and the patron.
But look, you have a situation where, you know, you go into a record store, like out here, you can go into record stores and up on the shelves where they have the records, it'll say thing like, you know, this, you know, Larry Levan, this was a Larry Levan garage classic, or Body and Soul type record, or, you know, which is basically saying, without the people even having to listen to it, like, you know, you got to have this record because Joe Clausel and Danny Crivet play it,
right.
You know, and so that's basically what I mean, like keeping up with the Joneses. So if every time you go to the store, that label is there that says buy this because Joe bought it, you want to, and you know, so you're trying to keep up with the guys that are on top thinking that's going to get you there, you know, because
wow.
you're playing all the hits, when to me I think, but then you have all the DJs that are in this form of house music that we like playing this brand, all playing the same 20 records,
right.
So what separates me from that guy?
Well, I could tell you what separates me from them. I don't pick the songs that they say is the hot pick or so-and-so is playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I pick what I want to pick,
mm-hmm.
what I want to introduce to my crowd.
Right.
What's going to be the hot pick for me, Tyrone, and Ray's party, you know. because that's where I want to go. That's the type of vibe we've created for ourselves. You have to build your own house. You can't build your house off of someone else's house. That's pretty much the way I see it.
And we are back talking with DJ Donna Edwards from New York City about club culture, the current state of house culture and music. I wanted to ask you as well about what you think about the state in general. We just finished talking about the music, and you know, you were saying before we went to break that you basically pick records from the heart. They have to move you. You're not just trying to follow, you know, every Tom, Dick, and Harry, which is cool. That's the way people, you should do it. You know, your record crate should be a reflection of you, not of the latest trends. But I was wondering, other than the quality of records, what do you think is going on with our culture? Because, I mean, hip-hop is everywhere. And from record sales to throwing parties, our culture is suffering big time.
It is. It's suffering big time because it's more of a social pop type thing because of the house being excluded from the dance departments and the record labels and being excluded pretty much off the radio unless you have dance mix shows going on. And it's all to do with the culture and who's running the music industry. To me, they don't want the younger people to have the meaningful music or to put forth what it should be, and that's spiritually and figuratively.
So if the record labels aren't going to do it, and of course we're talking the major record labels because we need them to distribute the smaller labels.
Right.
If the record company won't do it, how can we be self-sufficient? How can we ensure that our records sell?
The downloading, pirating of music is not good at all. It takes away from the artist. It takes away from the label. They're losing a lot of money, but asking millions of people to not download, I don't think that's going to happen.
The industry, on the one hand, is so quick to blame the consumer. They're really not looking at themselves in some way, too. I mean, we're so technologically advanced. I mean, the downfall of the music industry started when they created the burners, period. The minute you made a recordable device, what did you think? People weren't going to use it? You know what I mean? And then on the other side, you know, piracy is an inside business. To have that kind of piracy going on, it has to happen at the engineering level. Someone in the recording studio is making a secret copy and taking things and burning them. You know what I mean?
Right. And that, you're absolutely right. Like, all the remixes they do and the bootlegs they put out. I mean, how do they get hold of the acapellas in the bootleg? It has to come from the inside.
Exactly. Exactly. Somebody has to give you that.
Right.
You know?
Someone that's working on the inside can't get access to it otherwise unless you're actually there in the studio when they're putting the tracks down. Someone in that person's camp.
Right.
So, you have to have more honest people around you as an artist or record label to ensure that your material's not stolen and copied illegally.
Right.
It's so many things.
Do you feel like the audience for this music is growing? Are we really introducing new people to the music to keep it alive, or is it the same population who grew up on it and now they're like aging up and aging out, you know?
I think it's still that some of the older folks are still hanging in there and holding on. But for the most part, you have the younger people filtering in, and the only way to keep them there, like I said, is to play the remixes of R&B tunes that they do know to keep them interested. And at some point, it becomes cool, or they can get used to it as opposed to the hip-hop sound of what they grew up on and kind of see what we see and felt as young when we were their age.
Right.
We were exposed to it. So we're winning over quite a few of them by doing it that way and not just totally alienate them and say, nah, we're just going to push it down their throats and play something that's a little bit more underground where they can't quite relate to yet. You got to start somewhere.
So you're feeling like the new people need to come in through the mainstream a little bit more.
Yeah, definitely. And some of the older people have to move on with the times also. You know, musically, some of them are stuck specifically in the classic realm. They don't want to hear anything else.
Right.
They just want to hear songs from the early 90s.
Right.
Like, okay, we have to move on because there's some great music out here. I mean, there's a lot of garbage, but out of 90 records, there's about 10 of them that's just going to be classics one day. And you got to move on. You got to listen to it. You got to tell the next person about it. Tell the children about it. Let them dance.
Do you think that there's a lot of sharing of information going on in terms of DJ to DJ?
No, it depends on which DJs it is. It depends. I mean, when I grew up, I didn't have any problem finding out the name of song and producers and labels and things like that. Some of the guys, they're pretty secretive because they just want to have it at the moment or whatever. But to me, it's like, why go through all that? The song is made to be shared.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Even if it's unreleased, granted, you can't give out unreleased material if it was given to you in that faith. But when it is available, let the person know so they can go buy it, you know, purchase the music. That helps the growth, that helps sales, and that helps promote the music. Let them know that it's coming. It's not out now, but it will be in 3 weeks or another month, and it's a hot tune. And keep playing it. That's the key. And if it's real hot, play it 4 times in the same night. I don't care, as long as they get it and they hear it.
A lot of people don't do that anymore, where they play a record twice. You know, sometimes I think the crowd doesn't get it. Like, this is a part of the culture. This is how you break a record. You can't just play it once and move on. I need to get you to love this record. You know, you have to hear it a couple times a night. And I think that sometimes now with the thing about multiple DJs, you know, you don't get to repeat records because you got to stand out. You have to be able to shine and be flashy. And
yeah, but see, I believe the opposite. You know, even if you're playing with other people, you can still break a record. If you're playing for 2 hours, play it every 30 minutes. That's how it goes. Bring it back.
30 minutes, y'all.
Bring it back. So that's your, you know, you're getting in your 4 turns. That has to be broken. And I think it's the age difference, too. The younger people, they didn't come up in that era, so they don't know that's how records were broken. But I guess the ones that really want to know and learn, they pay attention. They'll find out and they'll see, you know. So if you go to the shelter, granted, if Timmy's breaking the record, you're going to hear it 3 and 4 times before the night is over. But that comes from his experience and him being an old school DJ. And he knows that's how you break a tune to the crowd. The younger people, if they really, really paid attention and learned some of the technical and the political and business side of it, other than the DJing, it would also help too.
Somebody's just got to pass that knowledge down. That's the other
right.
thing.
Right. It's kind of...
It's so competitive. Weird.
Yeah, that's what I mean by, like, when I grew up, at least I had people like T. Scott, Big Bob. They talked to me directly, and they answered my questions. You know, I'm not really sure how open some of the big name DJs are to other DJs.
So let's talk about music production for you. Are you producing? I know you do some re-editing of tracks, but what are your future plans? Do you feel like you're ready to make records?
Yes, I feel that I'm ready, but I want to do it when the time is right. I mean, I do mostly edits now, but my heart is really into DJing, and that's what I'm feeling and have been feeling all these years. I don't want to just put out a record just to say I put out a record or my name's on that record, you know, which I feel a lot of people are doing today. It's not good. My main focus has always been to make people dance and someday get into the studio. And I know I will do it. I hope I do it soon, but I'm not pushing for it, but I'll know when the time is right to do it and which song would actually fit me and how I feel. I just, when I figure out which avenue I want to take it musically as far as the record, then I'll be able to do it. Editing part, that's the easy part, because I can hear a hook in a song and I know what I want to hear again or what I feel is the hottest part of that song, and it just has to be repeated. Or if it's just a beat that puts you in a trance, it has to be extended, you know. And that comes from DJing and listening and learning from other people like T, you know, actually doing it. Or doing it live, you know?
But are you trying to get into that business of doing re-edits the way, like, Danny Crivet is doing? Or, again, is that something you're not really trying to push that or pursue that?
Yeah, at this point, I'm kind of leaning towards doing it. I just have to find the time, like I said, the right time, you know? Other than my DJing, I work another job, so it's hard. My time is real thin. I mean, I know for sure when you're in the studio, you got to really have the time to do it, to put out quality music.
How long do you think you'll maintain the day gig, Donna? You've been in this business for a long time now.
I'll put it this way. As long as God give me good health and I can still stand and wake up every day, I want to do it all.
So let's talk about your new party that you got going for those folks who are visiting the Big Apple. Where is it? All that stuff.
Theory is going to be on, it's actually in Brooklyn on Myrtle Avenue, 527 Myrtle Avenue. It's a new party. We're starting from 9 to 4 a.m. And the DJs will be myself, Little Ray, and Tyrone Francis. I hope and pray that the party will last and everybody comes out and just enjoy it.
Well, you would definitely have to keep us updated on how that's going and let us know that it's still going so we can, you know, direct people that way when they're, you know, our Angelinos are visiting New York and they're looking for parties to check out.
Oh, that sounds great. I definitely will.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's really going to about do it for the program. If you got any shout outs, now's the time.
First, I want to thank you for inviting me to do the show. It was great. I had fun. I'm kind of breathless right now, but it was great. And I want to say hi to everybody there in California and all my friends back here in New York. Say, hey, what's up to G-Man at Deep House Page?
Oh, yeah.
That I want to meet also.
Actually, that's something I should let folks know. If you want to hear more of Donna's mixes, one of the places that you can check out is a website. If you don't already know about it, if you're a serious house head, you definitely need to check it out. It is the Deep House Page, www.deephousepage.com. If you go into their mix archives, you will hear some unbelievable mixes by legends, by future legends. Donna has mixes on there. You have got to check out the Deep House Page. Your mixes can also be heard on the New York Archives Underground.
UndergroundArchives.com. That's UNDA Archives.com.
Underground, not under.
Right.
UndergroundArchives.com.
Right.
Is there any place else? Do you have your own website with your mixes? Where else can we hear some of your stuff?
No, pretty much those are the two top sites that I submit my mixes to. Currently, I'm getting ready to do one more for housecalls.com, a New Jersey-based site by DJ Ossie's. Just asked me to do a few shows for him.
Okay.
But I can't have that ready until next week.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to get you to do some Restless Soul mixes for sure. So we can have like another outlet for your music.
I would love to.
But again, that's going to do it for this edition of Restless Soul. And I want to thank Donna. Thank you so much for taking the time to hang out and talk and chat. It has definitely been my pleasure. And I'll be back next week with more good music right here, 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara County, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond. And we'll see you next week.